Hello, welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman, and it's really nice to be back. I know it's been a while. My guest today is Amanda Bidnall. She's the author of The West Indian Generation, Remaking British Culture in London, 1945 to 1965, with Liverpool University Press. This book is a careful and beautifully rendered examination of a generation of artists, writers, and musicians who landed in post-war London and navigated the cultural and aesthetic politics there. Less about racial division and conflict, and more about finding ways to belong to a late imperial Britain. The West Indian generation Bidnall writes about has not received the attention it deserves. It's a wonderful book, and I'm really glad to be speaking with Amanda today. Hi, Amanda. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out with a little bit about yourself. How did you come to this project? How did you come to be a historian? Tell us how you got to where you are today.
Well, this project, in some ways, it came out of nowhere in the sense that I was doing my PhD and I really didn't, I mean, I consider myself a British cultural historian, but I hadn't done a lot of work on race, or even decolonization. My previous work had been about working class women. It was really almost purely an intellectual decision. I've always been really interested in the 1950s. I think that decade is, whether you're talking about Britain or not, if you're talking about the Western world, I don't know, people always talk about it as being a very conservative decade. This attempt to get back to normal after the war, but I always felt like it was always this wonderful puzzle. There was so much going on under the surface. The people who took a stand in the 50s, I feel like they were so admirable because they were really seizing on this impulse to create something new, to change things. So I guess I started thinking about, you know, you have this group of people who start their life in the British Caribbean as British subjects and who, for various reasons, move to England and they become British citizens, no red tape. And so they were really kind of uniquely positioned to create some kind of new vision, to talk about themselves, to talk about England and how England could be better. It was really just sort of an intellectual question I had with not really very much background, sort of what the answer would be, but I kind of wanted to explore it. And it was really interesting because I still remember when I was in a class and we were trying to hash out what our topics would be for our dissertations. And I sort of mentioned this sort of intellectual dilemma. And the professor who was running it, who's a wonderful historian, a wonderful person, he said, you really want to make sure that you are not just writing about Black people in Britain, but that you're writing about Britain. You really want this to be a British history. And at the time, I was sort of befuddled by that remark because I'm thinking, well, it would be British. It would be British just by the nature that these people were British. They were in Britain. And then as I started doing research and my sort of the story started coming together, I realized how true that was, how I could look at their cultural work and I could see it so much as part of the larger British cultural narrative. And so that was, at some point, the kind of contribution I decided to make.
Yeah, I guess that's interesting coming from the perspective of a Caribbean historian, sort of thinking about that as the boundaries, if they are even there, between Caribbean and British history. But I want to start with the title, actually. The West Indian Generation, and you say right at first that this is the story of a generation, and you set us up really nicely with Carolyn Steedman, and you suggest that this is a generation that's been overlooked by historiography of racial division. And I wonder if you can speak to that and talk a little bit more about what this particular generation contributes to that, or sort of how you see it as contributing to the historiographic project.
Mm-hmm. That title didn't come to me right away. And it was only after really working with the research and working with, with this body of writing I had, that I really did start to think of them as a generation and as kind of a unique generation. There is a framework in a lot of sort of Black British history that is what I would say kind of a conflictual framework, that sort of marks off, discrimination, whether it's popular discrimination or whether it's built into the legal or political framework, as being a really foundational thing. And I agree with that. I think that's a very, very smart way to look at the post-war history. But in this early period, it wasn't so firm. And I think that this group of people they did come from different walks of life, but they also had a really sophisticated politics. They really did have a politics, and it wasn't the same as what would come later, that what would come in the late 1960s and 1970s and 1980s. I think in some ways there was a real optimism about the power of education to change things, to improve quote unquote race relations. And that sort of really sophisticated politics, I feel like that has been overlooked. The idea that they could balance a respect for Britain, for British culture, a real love for that. I mean, having grown up with that kind of education, and sort of balancing that with also a really lively politics of anti-discrimination, a lively politics of anti-colonialism. So they could combine the two in a way that I feel like has been a little bit overlooked. And I feel like that's fascinating to look at.
I want to get into the details of these people a little bit later, but first, can you set the stage for us? What was the Britain that these artists walked into?
It was a real fresh, I would say a real fresh post-war Britain. There was, other historians have talked about this, people like Wendy Webster and Jordana Belkin, but there was a sense of, there was an afterglow from the British victory in the war, and that this was not just a British victory, but this was a European victory, but it was also a British imperial and a Commonwealth victory. People tend to poo-poo the importance of the Commonwealth as an entity, but also as an idea. And I think that idea was still very potent and held a lot of promise for a lot of people, not just in the colonies, but in the British government and in the British media and at the BBC and places like that. So I do think that, again, people talk about this push towards conservatism, but I also think there was a real optimism about the possibilities, about making life better for people, about making a Britain and a British Empire or a British Commonwealth that could be a force of good. And again, it all sounds kind of cheesy and it sounds kind of corny these days, but I do think it was a powerful influence. And you see it in the media in Britain at the time. And it was definitely a vision, I think, that was shared by a lot of the migrants who came over after the war.
So let's talk about the artists a little bit and the organization of the book. The book has artists at the center, but it's not necessarily organized by individuals, but rather by media or institutions. So we have radio and a little bit of TV. We have music and Calypso in particular. We have sculpture with the work of Ronald Moody, and then a chapter on film and one on theater. So can you talk a little bit about why you decided to organize it this way, and how hard was it to choose the particular artists you ultimately rested on?
Well, I wish I could say that it was a grand plan from the beginning. It absolutely wasn't. It really was a product of the research and what I could find. And then it did end up kind of slotting into these sort of different media or different art forms, which was kind of nice. So they do kind of function as individual case studies, but I'm also trying to balance that with making some larger arguments or seeing some larger patterns in all these different people's work. And I mean, some of these people didn't even know each other, so that's an added challenge. But it really was a product of getting enough information, finding enough research on. Again, this was not a there was not this really vivid West Indian community that had kind of coalesced or become or had self-identified in the 1950s. So, you know, when I went to the BBC Written Archives, which was the first place I visited, and I remember going in thinking, I'm going to find nothing. I had booked in 3 days and I was thinking, I might find nothing. I might be done by 2 o'clock. But in the end, I found all kinds of stuff. But it was the stories of Edra Connor and Pearl Connor and Cy Grant that I felt like I had the most meat. And the same with like someone like Ronald Moody. His papers had just become available actually at the Hyman Kreitman Research Center, which is part of the Tate. So I really kind of seized on that. It was really about availability. I'm not saying that there's not a lot of other stuff out there. But you know, for my kind of limited time I had in London, these were the documents that I found. So I guess I was just lucky that I was able to kind of pull at least one great story from each of these different archives that I visited.
Yeah, let's start with the BBC. It was home to and actually ended up engaging a lot of West Indian artists.
Yes.
And you have the Connors and then Cy Grant. And so how would you characterize their contribution? What did they bring to the BBC?
Again, this is really cumulative. Again, I pulled a few individuals, but you know, the BBC was, I mean, it was, if you were a cultural person, if you were a poet or a writer or an actor or a singer, I mean, and you came to London, the BBC was almost the first place you would go. And it was probably the place where you had the biggest chance of initial success anyway. So, I mean, the BBC, again, with its commitment to public service and public education, again, in the aftermath of the Second World War, there was a real feeling at the BBC that to get as many of these people on the air as possible on television or later on television or on the radio. And it wasn't just for the overseas services. Of course, you know, that was a huge source of employment for a lot of Commonwealth and British subjects in London. But I mean, with the increasing visibility of migration, West Indian migration to London, there was a real feeling in the BBC about trying to sort of jump on this and represent it to the British public. And I think there probably was a desire to, you know, be the first to represent it or to have some control over how that was represented. There is a sense within the BBC of, you know, again, that this is about educating, you know, British radio listeners or British TV viewers. And so I think there was a sense that we've got to do this in what they viewed as the right way. I think, you know, a lot of the cultural diversity that the BBC wanted to present, especially from the British Empire and Commonwealth, that was, you know, a lot of that could come from these new arrivals.
And yet at the same time, I found this really interesting part of the chapter. Towards the end, the BBC seems to tire of them a little bit and move on. And you kind of slid over that a little bit. I was wondering if you can talk a little more about that and maybe sort of speculate as to why that happened.
I'm not even sure if I would put it that way, that it was losing interest. Certainly in the case of particular individuals like Edric Connor, you can see that. But I think with Edra Connor and Cy Grant, and this probably didn't happen very much because, you know, they were two of probably the most visible West Indian personalities on the sort of BBC as far as the home services were concerned, as far as the British public was concerned. And they both got to a place where they had that visibility, they had that clout, and as would be very natural, they wanted to use that. They wanted to use that to, whether it was in the case of Cy Grant, to branch out to different kinds of roles. I feel like Cy Grant really had a lot of star power. And he was a real natural in that sense. And I think I got the feeling that he wanted to capitalize that on much as much as possible. With the case of Edric Connor, I felt like he really had a very kind of altruistic, he wanted to increase the visibility and the respect of the West Indian community. He wanted, and not just in London, but also in the Caribbean. And so he really wanted to promote that culture and make that more visible instead of being sort of slotted into whatever roles, singing or dramatic roles that the BBC thought were suitable. So they both were individuals that got to that point where they could actually have that discussion because they gained enough notoriety to do that. And so it's in their cases that you really see this push and pull. And yeah, and eventually, you know, eventually you see where that ceiling was for the BBC. You know, they really wanted to promote Cy Grant. They wanted to put him in all kinds of stuff. But ultimately, you could see their discomfort with having him as a leading man. And with Edric Connor, who wanted to, he wanted to start directing his own stuff. And yeah, and he was really about, I mean, he had been interested in Caribbean folklore even when he first came over. So that was still a real passion project for him. And he wanted to go to the Caribbean. He wanted to film footage there. And you could see them again backing away. You know, we could do this better in our own studios instead of having that more authentic footage. So yeah, so they're both interesting in that you see. I mean, one thing I kind of suggest in this project is that by focusing on these instances of collaboration, it's not in an effort to paint this really rosy picture where everyone got along and then later on they didn't. It's actually really useful for finding the limits of that collaboration. So you can start to see this early post-war period and see how it is a precursor and not a stranger to the period that followed it. You know, if there is disillusionment in the West Indian community or among Black artists by the late 60s and 70s or early 60s, where does that come from?
Yeah.
And there you can see, well, okay, you know, there was a lot of acceptance from the BBC and they really had a explicit mission to for this kind of diversity. But you can see where ultimately those ambitions on behalf of their artists would ultimately be frustrated.
Yeah, there was a kind of, I thought there was a contrast between that and the Calypso musicians who seemed better able to find these ready-made contexts to slide into. Not that they were necessarily sort of more accepting, but that they were just sort of more more wholly constructed for them to be able to fit into. I mean, you have this really wonderful quote about the Calypsonians that are in London. And it's amazing that they were all there, Lord Kitchener, Lord Invader, Lord Beginner. And you say about them that they, quote, articulate a generous late imperial vision of belonging in the 1950s. I love the way you phrase that. And so how does that work? And how complex was the music? Because, I mean, you do talk about the ways that it sort of, with satire and sort of double entendre, sort of, it insinuates things about racial tensions, but it's also very playful. And so I want to hear more about mm-hmm. that music.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like the Calypsonians benefited from not having to work with an institution like the BBC or any kind of big institution. I mean, they were playing small clubs, in some cases opening their own clubs outside of London. And they were operating in this sort of nightclub atmosphere, although you can see them sort of moonlighting or daylighting, you know, in spots on the BBC, writing music for the BBC or for other television companies at the time, and getting that kind of, I did get that kind of real public exposure. I mean, you know, about Princess Margaret being this huge Calypso fan and she loved Lord Kitchener and all this kind of thing. But really, I mean, in terms of their bread and butter, they were, you know, working at nightclubs and that sort of thing. And so I feel like they really could, they could be a little franker and they could be a little naughtier about how they wrote about race or how they wrote about living in London. So that was an opportunity and still be very popular. But yeah, I felt like they really, I feel like they really shouldered their way in, you know, things, you know, writing songs about things that would be taboo in another context, writing about, you know, white female police officers in England in a sexual way, which, you know, would have been, you know, the subject of an Ealing Studios movie with great, you know, shocking gasps and that sort of thing. And yet they just wrote about that stuff. They wrote about mixed marriages in a way that the BBC would have program. You know, I came across a program about mixed marriage, and again, in this very serious context, like, do mixed marriages work? And you have, you know, Nadia Catus, who was a West Indian actress who was married to a white Englishman, and, you know, her talking about it in a very serious way and in a way to educate people. And yet these Calypsonians can write about it in a sort of really jubilant way, just sort of embracing it without all of that, you know, without all of that fanfare, without all of that kind of shock and awe. So. And I mean, I don't know if this is, I mean, that's partly their pedigree. And if you look at, you know, the research subjects that come up in my book, the majority of them, not all of them, but the majority of them were middle class in the West Indies. You know, Stuart Hall has written about how when he was a kid, he would never have been allowed to go near a Calypso tent because that was low class. And he wasn't. So in that case, the Calypsonians are bringing that same attitude over with them, you know, to London, operating in a slightly different sphere, but still managing to gain that visibility, have their lyrics gain that visibility. And there is a sense that they were writing to a British audience in the sense that they knew that, you know, that British people wanted to hear calypsos about London, or they wanted to hear calypsos about, you know, British politics. And so they catered to that. They did cater to that audience.
Yeah. And then sort of moving along to the next person that you talk about, Ronald Moody, who's similarly, I guess I would say, ambivalent about some things West Indian, you could maybe put it that way. Mm-hmm. But you open with an anecdote about how he didn't like to be called a Black British artist. But at the same time, he was also deeply influenced by African forms and African art that he came to through, you argue, a kind of European context, right? And I thought that he was really one of the more complicated figures
in this book.
Yeah. And so here's the question. If he didn't want to be called a Black British artist, how do you think he would have liked to have been remembered? And what was he reaching for in his sculptures?
Right. This was the hardest chapter to write. I really, really wrestled with it because I felt like that was just what you asked. How would he describe himself? How would he want to be remembered? I really struggled with that. I wasn't getting a really clear answer. And what I realized, I mean, because in this case, I have a chapter on one individual really working largely in isolation. And you know, people are complicated. You can't. We're talking about experience. We're talking about art, and you cannot reduce it to a sort of pithy sentence. But what I realized is that what was really fascinating to me is not just about how he would define himself, but how over time people defined him, and how that changed, and how you can see patterns in that. And these were not necessarily things that these were not necessarily categorizations that he ever encouraged. I think he would have probably called himself a universalist. He seemed to see commonalities between these ancient cultures that he was so influenced by, whether he's talking about India, whether you're talking about, you know, Egyptian statuary. And then eventually, not at the beginning, but later on, looking at Caribbean folklore and that sort of thing. And I think he saw all these things as being unified in a particular way philosophically. And in some ways, he saw them as, and this is not unusual for artists at the time, as seeing these in stark opposition to the progress of like Western art or Western culture, philosophy, which he saw, I mean, rightly so, considering his experiences in the Second World War, as basically coming to their nadir with the onset of nuclear war and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think he would have seen himself as a sort of universalist. I think he would have been against being pigeonholed in any way, you know, and this, that goes back to that quote you referred to. He said, mm-hmm. I'm an artist first and foremost. That's how he would identify himself. And that, I mean, maybe that's not helpful for people, but I think again, you know, he's one man and historically looking at him in a larger concept is looking at how this same person with really reasonably consistent approach and reasonably consistent beliefs can be categorized so differently over time.
Yeah. And the politics of those categorizations mm-hmm. just keep changing. It's mm-hmm. it's really fascinating to think about somebody like that. Mm-hmm. So moving towards the final chapters in which you take up film and then theater, and then also really sort of hinge them around these brothers, Lloyd and Barry Record, who seem mm-hmm. to loom, this seems to be everywhere.
they do.
during this period. But one of the nice things about both of these chapters is that you really, you take two or three films, two or three plays, and really track this kind of evolution in the ways that the representations of things changed, even in the course of, I don't know, maybe not even two decades, just a mm-hmm. decade and a half mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. So and at the same time, there's some really persistent themes. So I wonder if you can just talk about, for instance, say The Pool of London and Flame in the Streets. What were those films? What was the difference between them? And what were the kind of threads that followed all the way through?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I seize on this figure of Earl Cameron because he appeared in a lot of these big movies that were supposed to be about, you know, race relations in England at the time. And he's always positioned a little differently. I mean, I feel like with Pool of London, which came out, I'm struggling to remember, I think it comes out in 1951, but with Pool of London, it's not even yet a, you know, the idea of you know, racial migration or West Indian migration or miscegenation or those concepts are not even really brought to the fore yet. You know, I think Earl Cameron plays a character named Johnny, and Johnny is, you know, not living in Britain. He works on a ship, and he sort of falls kind of helplessly infatuated with, you know, one of the main characters, a white woman. And yet that relationship is sort of neutered in a couple of ways. One is that Johnny's character is, you know, he's so innocent. He's almost like, he's like a young boy who has dreams, but that's it. There's no kind of real grit to his character at all. And that neither of them think of the idea of a kind of romantic relationship as even a possibility. They share this sort of touching connection, but again, it's very innocent. So you can see, you know, this movie kind of, and that in itself is a sort of secondary plot line as well. Whereas by the time you get to Flame in the Streets, which is, you know, 12 or 13 years later, you know, the attitude has changed completely. And that is a movie, that is about class, but it's also very, very much about, you know, race relations. And again, it's always a white woman and a black man. But that movie, more than any of the movies that came before it, took it as its centerpiece. And not just in, you know, the central love story, but also in its attempt to give more of a context to look at other couples who are other mixed race couples to try to zoom out even in a small way from this kind of central domestic drama. It doesn't totally succeed, obviously, in doing that. But by that time, that movie was presented as a sort of flaming inferno of passion. The fact that it takes place on, or the climax happens on, Guy Fawkes Night is literally a burning inferno. And that was very much how it was presented. And it does say something about the way that quote unquote specter had moved to the forefront of sort of popular discussion.
How do you think we would watch those films today?
Well, we would, and I think this is how a lot of people have, in the past who've written about them have seen them as, or at least until comparatively recently. I mean, if you watch any of those movies singly, you would see just stereotypes. That's what you would see. You would see that this is a bunch of stereotypes. But actually, if you watch them in succession, and again, you have this helpful figure of Earl Cameron, who is consistently in these movies in various roles, and he always had a real sort of quiet dignity about him. I think it's kind of wonderful that he was ultimately the person who played these roles, because I have never seen him in a role where he is not worthy of respect, you know, where he is a figure of, where he's poked fun at, or he's, even when he plays someone who later on in the mid 60s, he starts playing people who are not wholly good or noble, that they are, you know, that they, you know, do, they're not perfect. But he still manages to kind of imbue them with dignity. But anyway, as you see these movies going along, you can see that there is at least an increasing attempt to challenge viewers' misconceptions or their assumptions, and to be more complex about it. I mean, this era, and I mean in general, 1950s film in Britain tends to be denigrated because it is so sort of pompously middle class, and it is so kind of, can be so cloying in its attempt to educate viewers or to talk about quote unquote serious issues. But I think we need to give it a little more credit and see. And again, you can see this attempt. There is this attempt at collaboration. And again, we can really see the limits of it, even by the mid-1960s. But it's still worthwhile looking at how that narrative progressed or how it changed over time.
It's interesting to put those up against the plays that you write about, because I think that the trajectory there is slightly different, actually. And you talk about Barry Record's plays and the theater, and that context seems somehow to be, I want to say, almost more sophisticated and recognized as such by the critics, right? So Flesh to a Tiger, there's so much to talk about in these three plays. Flesh to a Tiger, which I was fascinated by the context of West Indian voices and accents in London, right? And how that was received.
Absolutely.
By some and not by others. And then You and Your Small Corner, that's also about class, and there was real emphasis about that. And then Skyverse, which has no Black people at all.
That's right.
Right? And then he's sort of finally rid of this, of the label of the Black dramatist. But you sort of argue that's still somehow about race, and it also speaks to the social issues. So, like, how do we put those plays in their context? They seem to be so different from each other, so different from the films. Actually, how do we think about those?
Well, I mean, you're not supposed to have favorites when it comes to research subjects, but I have a couple of favorites. I really love Pearl Connor. Because you can see these interviews with her when she's in her 80s or even 90, and she's still so sharp. And she did so much tremendously behind the scenes. She was just smart as whip. But I also love Barry Record because he was such an iconoclast. And he took issue with everything, and yet he was also extremely political. And I think in his plays, you can see, especially You and Your Small Corner, which would probably be the obvious thing you'd think of, but you can really see how, which goes back to sort of one of my original arguments, which is that, you know, if you look at these artworks or you look at these programs or you look at this creative output that is coming from the West Indian artistic community or these West Indian artists, whether singly or whether in collaboration with British companies or institutions, you really see that, at least in the 1950s, that this is not just a reaction to mainstream British culture. It is a real complement to it. And we really should look at these cultural artifacts along with everything else, because it really enhances that post-war British cultural narrative. And I feel like he really does that. So you take a play like You and Your Small Corner, which I was thinking about this just the other day, which in some ways is so much like that, you know, that beacon of Royal Court's reputation, Look Back in Anger. And it takes so many of its beats from that. And I have no idea whether that was intentional or not. I think it wasn't. I'm not sure he was, if he had followed that play. And maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But either way, he is taking this narrative of working class angst. and again, this idea of, like, you know, this working class man trying, not having a place for himself. And he's taken a narrative and he's added this element of colonialism and race and class and education that just enriches it so much, while at the same time finding a place for, you know, or showing the place of West Indian artists and West Indian people in these big questions. So anyway, I feel like I've drifted off topic, but yeah, I mean, I feel like because he was working with the Royal Court, which had this self-conscious mission to exhibit different voices, but also to exhibit different voices, but also to exhibit them as part of, you know, to more accurately represent British society, you know, to showcase voices that might not have been heard in British theater before, that probably definitely hadn't been heard in British theater before. And I feel like Barry Record really did slot into that. And he was, I mean, he was an angry young man, if you can call any of these people angry young men. So you can take a play like Flesh to a Tiger and you think, okay, it's set in Jamaica. And there's not really much reference to Britain at all. it's really about, it's about Jamaican, class and about religion and things like that. And yet the Royal Court embraced it for what it saw as its authenticity, for its inherent drama. And because Barry Record was living in London at the time, I mean, this was the new British drama, even despite the fact that it's not explicitly addressing, you know, issues that might be pertinent to domestic Britons. But of course, by his second play, You and Your Small Corner, that him as a new voice of British drama becomes much clearer. Until by the end, when you get to Skivers, he's taken a question that, you know, that could have been a play about race. It could have been a play about race relations, but I feel like in making it to play about the British education system, and working class students who are dealing with an education that's preparing them for a future in a dead end job, that gives them no scope at all for, you know, personal passion or intelligence. I feel like he's, you know, you can say, oh, he's thrown off the West Indian dramatist tag, but I feel like if you look at his body of work, he's drawing connections. You know, he's drawing connections between, you know, between these two very different, what people would see as two very discrete subjects, and he's putting them within the same frame.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like in some ways what this book does is just really shift perspective, but it remains with the West Indians in London. And so what you get is this kind of countercurrent against so much of the literature about the 1950s and the West Indies is about proto-nationalism and the emergence of a nationalism, a kind of budding nationalism, and mm-hmm. sort of looking towards the future and all of that kind of stuff. And you just you see something so different here. I think that you've really made a case for their presence in a very British context. It's really fascinating. And I guess to wrap up, I'm wondering how all of these cultural artifacts, these figures, these plays and films, how are they being remembered in the UK today, or even in the West Indies? Are there revivals of this material, or are they being taken up again? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does any of this stuff resonate anew? You think
it is starting to? It is starting to. You still don't hear much about, for example, Barry Record. although I don't know why. Although his play Skivers, which got the best, Bust You a Tiger had gotten mixed reviews at the time. Both You and Your Small Corner and Skivers were very well received, but You and Your Small Corner was staged on a much smaller scale at the theater upstairs. So Skivers was probably his most prominent play, and it was revived. And it was, I want to say, in the early 2000s, not long before he passed away, maybe a couple of years before he passed away. And he, apparently he was very touched because he had no idea that any of his plays would ever be staged again. But it really, you know, reviews of it at the time, you know, talk about how much those themes still hold up, how much that play holds up and is still kind of relevant in British society. But as far as the others, absolutely, Ronald Moody, who upon his death had really been largely forgotten. And I think his niece Cynthia Moody, who had sort of inherited all of his papers and his estate, she did a lot of work to make him more visible. And I feel like you can see Ronald Moody also got, he got a lot of work as a portrait sculptor. So his portrait of Harold Moody, his brother, is on display at the National Gallery's National Portrait Gallery, excuse me. At least it was the last time I was there. And so it is, you are having, some of these people are being remembered, some more so than others. And I feel like it's a way that, you know, a lot of these artists by the early 60s were feeling very rejected. I feel like they had this beautiful vision of what Britain could be, how it could really be a multicultural place, how you could celebrate all these different cultures from all across the empire and Commonwealth. And I feel like their vision was just rejected by the 60s. And I feel like now, very, very belatedly, there is an attempt to kind of rehabilitate some of their work in a way to, you know, remember that beautiful image. And it's almost very bittersweet to see these people, some of these people, finally getting recognized.
Yeah, I mean, as people, as you say, it might sound a little bit cheesy, but there is this way in which people seem to be looking for hope or sort of something more hopeful these days.
absolutely.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to these guys.
Yeah, I will. And I feel like this book is, I was doing the research and this book has come out really at the very end of these people's lives. It was really when I started doing research that, you know, quite a few of them died within a 5-year span or something like that, or 5 or 10 year span. Mm. So I feel like it is the perfect time to remember them for sure.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really had a great time.
Yeah, no, likewise. Thanks so much for having me.